Marsh from Soccer here. Welcome back to The Realignment. We have a great episode today that we are sure you all are going to enjoy. We're speaking with Kara Frederick. She is a research fellow in technology policy at the Heritage Foundation. For that, she worked at the Center for New American Security, Facebook, and the Defense Department. Her perspective is really interesting for today's topic because she has recently written a big report out at Heritage called Combating Big Tech's Totalitarianism, a Roadmap. That is linked in the show notes if you'd like to learn more. We definitely take audience feedback and are well aware of the fact that recent episodes have focused a lot on the center and the left. So it's good to dive back into the huge debates in DC and beyond about where the right is going from here. Kara was the perfect person to talk about this with. We had so many different topics. Obviously, we're starting with the tech question. We quickly move into the misinformation, disinformation space, debates around nuance and whether or not we could have good faith discussions. Lots of really great stuff here that I'm sure everyone's going to enjoy. Because I tended to disagree a bit with Kara and Sagar, I'd love for audience members to jump into the comments on the Substack this week or to our replies at realignmentpod@gmail.com if you have a different perspective. Quick things, there's no book to sell this week because Kara is just a research fellow of her report, but we'd love if you followed the link to our bookshop to purchase authors who've appeared on the show. You help support independent booksellers, authors, and we get 10% of the cut to help pay for our production costs here at the show. Secondly, there is a Substack. It goes out on Thursdays. It's really fun and a great place to come if you are an audience member who holds a different point of view. Finally, this is a huge chance to thank Lincoln Network for supporting our work, especially because Lincoln's really interested in how the right and the center, and basically everyone, is debating the future of tech. On this note, a fan favorite guest on the show has been Antonio Garcia Martinez. And Antonio has recently joined Lincoln Network, where he does a lot of writing and research on the future of internet, speech, Web3. He wanted us to call out the fact that on February 17th at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, he's going to be hosting a really interesting discussion about a new book. It's called The Founders. It's about the founding of PayPal. The author, Jimmy Soni, is actually going to be a guest on The Realignment next week. But interestingly enough, Peter Thiel, David Sachs of the All In podcast are going to appear on this call-in chat with him. So if you want to see the link, this is also available in the show notes as well, too. Really interesting story. You're kind of probably wondering, why are we having a specific episode and conversation around this topic? Well, it happens to be so many people from Elon Musk to Peter Thiel to David and beyond spent their early days in Silicon Valley at this company. So this conversation is going to be more than about what the world looked like in 2001 and really about what that company meant for the future of tech in Silicon Valley. So you can follow the link in the show notes to see Antonio's conversation when it comes out live or afterwards on the 17th at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. No more ado. Welcome to the episode. Welcome back to The Real Life. Kara Frederick, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
Kara, let's start with your background. Before you were at Heritage, before you were at CNAS, you were at Facebook. What did you do there?
Yeah, so I helped start and run the counterterrorism analysis team for global security, intelligence, and investigations. I also ran another team. It was a regional headquarters intelligence team. So it was really based off of surfacing high quality, publicly available information to help improve our platform-based reactions at Facebook. So what it means, I guess, in layman's terms is if there were a terrorist attack somewhere in the world, like the Christmas market truck attack in Berlin, my job was to communicate what exactly happened, what we knew to senior leadership, and also try to detect if this person, if we had a name, if we had a cunha, so like a funny name, something, a nom de guerre that they went by, if we could figure out if they were using Facebook, if God forbid they had conducted some operational planning on the platform, my job was to be sort of the first line of defense in that regard. try to identify them, and then work with engineers to build tools to basically get them off the platform sooner. So I was sort of like a node in the cross-functional teams between the trust and safety engineers, the InfoSec, the data scientists, the policy people, to figure out how to just be better at counterterrorism on the platform and give them that surrounding amplifying information about what it also looks like in real life as well. So they could figure out how to make Facebook better. And we called it more hostile to terrorists on the platform.
Yeah, I've always, even though I complain about it a lot, I've always said I have deep sympathy for the people who actually have to do this stuff, because it sounds like a freaking nightmare.
Oh, it is.
One interesting thing, and part of the reason we wanted to have you on, is Marshall and I were very skeptical of Facebook whistleblower kind of Francis Haugen. You were kind of held up and testified also at the time in December as a former Facebook employee becoming more from the right. Politico even wrote it up. Where would you say that you most differ from Francis Haugen as an ex-Facebook employee in the public, but also advocating for policies against your former employer?
Yeah, so I think we diverge pretty soon in terms of the problem diagnosis and definitely in terms of the solution. So when it comes to the problem diagnosis, I mean, I think you've sort of heard it all before from the left. They want more censorship, more government involvement to police speech. They want to create more government apparatuses run, from the top down to look at these content moderation practices and basically enhance and sharpen them. In terms of solutions, Francis advocates for the creation of a new agency to police speech effectively. And, when the government can't even decide what misinformation means or give a consistent definition of misinformation, I'm very wary of creating an entire government-run apparatus around that. And I think it's going to result in just generally more censorship. I think her motivations, as she articulated in the Wall Street Journal profile on her, not just in the Facebook files, but she said she was worried about her Midwestern friend who had been enthralled to disinformation and misinformation on the platform. And she decided to sort of make it her life's mission to go forward and combat this scourge of disinformation and misinformation. In my mind, I think that because that definition right now is used as the catch-all for any, dissenting opinion or viewpoint from sort of these prevailing narratives that come from the top down, that worries me when we're saying, no, we're going to lean into this. I want the opposite. I want less government involvement in terms of policing speech. Look at Jen Psaki. I know that in July, when she went up and was like, these people are purveying disinformation, within a month, Facebook took these accounts and users off the platform. Again, when the Spotify issue, stood up at the White House podium and said, hey, Spotify, there's much more that you can do. Surgeon General follow suit. The DHS Secretary Mayorkas, he basically said, we're working with these companies to police speech. Joe Biden issuing a blanket appeal to tech companies to police speech. So we differ in the problem diagnosis. I think that tech companies should not be the arbiters of truth. I think she wants to lean more in that direction and then give government cover to police speech. We're completely misaligned in that regard.
Yeah, got it.
So this is interesting because I agree with your point around misinformation as a label, especially if you see it in a news article, is just not a helpful framework for thinking this through. Let's be nuanced then and zoom in on some of the categories within them. Because like you said, you worked at Facebook in some of the highest stakes part of Facebook. So you're well aware of the fact that algorithms can promote case-by-case basis, legitimately dangerous, bad content. So the question is, in those actual cases, right, when we three could sit down and say, hey, like this person is actually spreading dangerous, not just like metaphorically anti-vax things. So not, oh, like this person's disagreeing on masking policies, but this person is literally saying something which isn't true, which I'm sure if we just Googled, we could find examples of these. What should tech companies do in those specific situations where we can in good faith agree there is something that's actually untrue, it's being said, that when amplified with an algorithm could actually lead to harm?
Yeah, so I think there's degrees of gradation here. And where I sort of, I think the premise is a good one. I think in an ideal world, we could actually have that process in place, Marshall, and have it work. But at this point, I think they've just been so corrupted in their application of what they say is a good faith definition of some of this information, that it worries me that you're going to have to go even to a preceding idea and think through, you know, is this possible? Possible for us to do, just because of generally Americans, as you know, we're so polarized in terms of what we actually perceive to be truth right now. The Wuhan Institute of Virology, right? Remember when Tom Cotton was called a conspiracy theorist because he was spewing this idea that now is pretty much, there's a consensus among some really serious thinkers that this is, that it could have, the COVID-19 could have resulted from a lab leak. So I think when it comes to what you're suggesting, tech companies just really have to go back to the basics because they've taken their eye off the ball. You know, I went to Facebook. I went from Naval Special Warfare Development Group, where I was a senior intelligence analyst, sort of doing this stuff in the digital space. I had experience at NSA as an embed doing the same kind of thing, attacking foreign Islamic terrorists in the digital atmosphere. Okay, so that is critical. That's why we started the counterterrorism analysis program at Facebook, to look at specific instances of real harm as defined by the State Department, you know, as defined by international organizations over decades of practice. I don't think we're there yet when it comes to misinformation. I think we need to focus on, you know, what we were doing best then, foreign Islamic terrorism, child exploitation. I think what a lot of people don't know is that the robust apparatus that grew around the child exploitation, the CSAM problem, that came first. So all of the muscle memory, all of the data scientists, the InfoSec engineers, and the policy guys, they really cut their teeth with the CSAM issue, right? Child porn, all of that.
Explain what CSAM is.
Oh, sorry. Child sexual abuse material. So when you have the internet, as the former deputy chief technology officer of the United States said, Nicole Wong, she said, if you build it, they will come, which effectively means you build the internet, even if your goals are noble, it still gets corrupted. Even if you want to democratize information, you're democratizing bad information for bad actors, and bad actors take advantage of it. So child porn, huge issue. What we were sort of dealing with in the 90s, when the whole Communications Decency Act of 1996, and the, you know, there were specific ideas that this was the objectionable content. This was the gross content that was proliferating. So Facebook mobilized in the beginning in its inception, and they were like, okay, child porn, this is a huge thing. We need to figure it out. So they did. And then after that came the foreign Islamic terrorism issue. And now you're dealing with the disinformation issue. But at this point, I think companies need to go back to what they were doing best. And they need to really focus on that activity, the CSAM activity as the premier thing to worry about, real terrorism as maybe another thing. And then you see there's all sorts of human trafficking now on Facebook. You had a regional VP actually admit this, that this is a problem for Facebook too. So let's focus on the genuine issues. And then you can attack with degrees of gradation, I think, the misinformation problem. But right now, I think they're just disinformation, misinformation. It's getting too much play. And these companies are fumbling around because they haven't yet perfected the human trafficking thing, the foreign Islamic terrorism thing. So in my mind, Marshall, I would love to answer that question and say, okay, here's a ready process, but let's fix what we can fix first. And then we can start to tackle that.
Let me
quick thing here. This is interesting because, as you said at the top, we're now at the point in the tech conversation where no one is pretending there's this like left, right, Democrat, Republican consensus against tech. I know, Sagar, you're not a huge Dan Crenshaw person, but in the article that you were citing in Politico, he actually had a good quote where he was like, look, people pretend there's this consensus. That is just not true. And that's a very useful takeaway. So I'm basically playing what a Democratic member of Congress would say to you, which they would say, Kara, that's why we think the government, through changing Section 230. So, for example, there are proposals that say whenever there is algorithmically pushed content. So, like, let's say when there's disinformation on Facebook, if the algorithm amplifies it, if it pushes it out there, if it really exposes it to people, Facebook could be liable for the type of content that's there, if it's actually serious and there are actual real consequences. So the legal system and the courts could work it out, and that could hypothetically provide the incentive for Facebook to actually get their stuff together in the way you articulated with the child porn and the Islamic terrorism issue. What's your response to, I think, that democratic argument against your point, which is saying, actually, Kara, democratic or governmental intervention can actually address this issue and make Facebook get their stuff together?
I think there's two issues here, and the conflation of the two is problematic. So I think you need to make them two discrete items, and then you can sort of start working there. So first and foremost, I would separate the idea that algorithmic ranking and amplification, I would say that process, companies should be liable for that process, because they are working with the content that this labeling that Twitter does, that kind of thing. They're editorializing this. So they're, nudging users in one sort of viewpoint direction. So as a separate idea, I think that's absolutely fair game when companies editorialize, because as you know, Section 230, it's immunity from civil liability when companies basically, there's a Good Samaritan clause when they remove content sort of in good faith, and they remove lascivious content and whatnot, otherwise objectionable. I think that's been interpreted very, very broadly, as Clarence Thomas laid out. He said the sweeping immunity granted by the courts over the years under the statute is something that he thinks should be on the table to be rectified. So I agree that these companies have been given an inch when it comes from that immunity from civil liability, and they've taken a mile. So, okay, let's talk about that. Let's talk about those ranking processes and how they tweak their algorithms, which, by the way, there's no transparency about that. It's in the Facebook files. Francis had to basically release the fact that they tweaked their algorithm in 2018 to increase the amount of incendiary content and engagement that the users would hopefully cleave to. But okay, I think talking about that is critical. Where I think that Democrat solution runs into a lot of issues is because these companies, and especially the government now, and we can talk more about that with the DHS bulletin that was just released and their definition of misinformation, disinformation, and malinformation as potentially inciting terrorist activity. I don't think the government can be trusted to have a consistent, agreed upon definition of misinformation in this climate. And then I think, secondly, big tech companies can't either. That's where we run into a lot of freedom of expression issues. You see what happens with Joe Rogan and Spotify, just by airing some of the ideas of Dr. Malone, Dr. McCullough, he's run into trouble because even he's a Bernie supporter, and he's still being painted as this, racist, white supremacist, et cetera, et cetera. So
Kara, let me follow up on something you just said, because this is very important. The DHS memo, which I am deeply concerned about, I covered it on my show Breaking Points. This actually, though, raises to a question I wanted to raise earlier when you were talking about, well, the State Department says, well, this is the Department of Homeland Security. So I would even question whether we should challenge your original idea that the government, aka even the, by defining terrorism, perhaps we might all agree, look, I don't want ISIS on the platform either. But if DHS gets to decide what a domestic terrorist or all that is that really a standard that we should even be comfortable with? And this is, my most libertarian part of me coming out, but has been awakened really by a lot of the codification of domestic terror language BS in the Biden administration or the DOJ so far. So, I mean, I'm almost challenging you directly on the work that you used to do. Do you think that fits with a kind of free speech goal that you are articulating here on the platform or on our podcast?
Sagar, yeah. 2 years ago, I would have pushed back so hard against you. I would have said, we've had decades of experience here. We've, issued draft to the public. We've had public input. We've had, two decades of experience of actually working through all of this data, determining a great definition of actual terrorism. We've seen it. We've lived it. I was overseas for three different tours doing it with my hands in the data. And I would have said, there's a lot of authority here and it's merited. Now, I think 2 years later, we've seen the definition inflation of domestic extremism, domestic terrorism. I think most illustratively in the National School Board Association letter saying that parents, you know, who are against CRT should be classified as domestic extremists. You know, Merrick Garland leapt on that. And according to Jim Jordan, within 5 days, he mobilized the huge counterterrorism apparatus of the DOJ and even the FBI to start tagging as terrorism. So I would have 2 years ago, I would have said, you're wrong. I would have had, frankly, just more faith in our institutions to mete out that kind of judgment and those assessments uniformly and fairly. Now, I completely agree with you. I will say that when we weren't just taking as gospel at Facebook when it came to foreign Islamic terrorism, we weren't just saying, okay, this is the brittle State Department definition. We can't deviate from them. We had a lot of smart people working in a lot of satellite offices overseas in all of these regions with regional expertise. So we did have more nuanced understandings, I would say, of how these actors behaved in the digital space. So we used the State Department definition to inform a lot of these policies that were created by the policy team. But we would have massive summits. We would all get together. We would brain dump. And then we would sort of figure out going forward how to continue to build the airplane in mid-flight, as we always said. So it wasn't gospel, but I think you touched on, honestly, the next fight of our generation, given the DHS bulletin and that just extreme definition inflation that's encompassing what really we would consider mainstream thought, and then, you know, heterodox viewpoints as well. I used to work on Chinese surveillance technologies and the social credit system and whatnot. And I would always say we have to be careful because, you know, dissenters are singled out by these automated processes and data integration for extra scrutiny. We're singling out dissenters for extra scrutiny with proclamations from the government like this. And the labels, it's just a normalization of using counterterrorism tools, which were very robust, created and iterated on over 2 decades, and turning them inward on the American population. That scares me the most out of any development that we've had from tech companies working with the governments now.
And the thing here that's interesting to me is, Sagar, pushing back on your framing a little bit, I think we can really put State Department statements on ISIS in a completely different bucket than the DHS conversation.
What about Russia, though? Here, I'll hit you on this one. So we just had this whole thing. The State Department spokesman says, trust us, we have intel that this video is out there of the Russians planning something. And our AP correspondent, Matt Lee, says, I don't believe you. Produce the evidence. And he doesn't say anything. So do they get set the standard? No, but why though? See, this is why it matters, which is that's the official position of the United States State Department, that this is a matter of truth. So should they get to decide if that's misinformation to question that on their platform?
Once again, this is what I'm saying though. Yeah. You're juxtaposing two different issues. When we're talking about 2015, 2016, we are talking about ISIS, which is an organized quasi-state, quasi-terrorist group, which was using Twitter, Facebook, and Carrie, you're the expert on this, so please jump in after me, who was specifically using these platforms to amplify their content, amplify soft power warfare and hard power warfare against the United States. I think that is an entirely different issue than the State Department making statements about what is happening in a Russia conflict. And once again, that wasn't, I don't think that issue that you're describing has anything to do with Facebook or social platforms at all. Here's what I was just trying to say, because I don't want to get to my question to Kara. All I was trying to say is 2014 through 2016, ISIS era terrorism debates are entirely separate from misinformation era COVID debates. I think we should live in a world where we could say, hey, the DHS, when it's focused domestically, is not in the same situation the State Department was in 2015 and 2016. So to my actual question, I think my question would be, and this is delicate, so I'm going to try to put it delicately. Let's get real, right? Just as during the war on terror, there were the outward-facing part, Afghanistan, war in Iraq, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, et cetera. But there were domestic terrorists. There were domestic sources, and there were aspects of the U.S. military-industrial system that were aligned against civilians in America who were doing things. There are right-wing terrorists. There are left-wing terrorists. There are all sorts of things. And it seems to me going too far to just take that off the table. So Kara, I know you're going to push back. So because it just seems that you could just listen to the words you're saying, and it's suggesting that because libs could be super libby and super annoying and bad faith, it seems like we are taking tools off the table when Timothy McVeigh, there clearly are American domestic terrorists. So help us get to the nuance of what we're discussing.
Yeah, so I think there's tons of issues here that we could sort of talk through. You raised a bunch of great ones. What I think, I do think it matters, actually, instead of saying stuff about, you know, the NSB, stuff about the DHS bulletin is overblown and whatnot. I think it matters because there's a normalization of that definition inflation, and it's being reflected in the digital space as well. So yes. You have what's going on in meat space, right? So you have all the NSB, what we talked about, DHS bulletin and whatnot. But there's a parallel thing happening in the digital space as well. And there's one thing really interesting. In 2016, Facebook led what we called the hash sharing consortium. So hashes are like digital fingerprints, basically the easiest way to describe it, the way Facebook describes them. And what we did was we partnered with YouTube, with Microsoft, and with Twitter. And we basically had a database filled with, say, something like an ISIS flag. So a photo DNA database. And in this database are ISIS flags. And the idea of this whole consortium was the fact that if someone uploads to Twitter a picture of an ISIS flag, then that process would be automated so that if it happened at Facebook, it's removed. If it happened at Google, or YouTube, it's removed. So, we shared that content because we could agree that ISIS was a bad threat actor and whatnot. Now, so that hash sharing consortium sort of birthed this external organization called GIFCT, the Global Internet Forum for Combating Terrorism. And now Facebook employees went over there and they're actively involved. I think Nick Rasmussen, who used to run NCTC, is the head of that. And they announced that they had too much of a bias and a focus on foreign Islamic terrorism. And they're going to start taking a look at right-leaning content. And as you say, there are really disgusting, noxious right-wing actors for sure out in the space. I mean, look at Norway, all of those things. New Zealand, very, very disgusting.
And you're referencing, just to these were attacks you're referencing.
While
you were at Facebook, correct?
One happened afterwards. The New Zealand one happened after. And others, I can't remember if. Bottom line is they were a problem. We recognize they're a problem. But okay, so now we're saying that they're going to expand this database to include right-leaning content. And in my mind, there's a massive slippery slope when you say, when you take your eye off the ball of actual, like real terrorism, real attacks, and start to, bleed into this sort of viewpoint thing. And I'd say it's demonstrated by, remember Kyle Rittenhouse when he was called a white supremacist in a Joe Biden ad campaign video, when, all of these, white supremacists, extremists, domestic terrorism, that sort of language is being normalized. And after January 6th, this is what gets me. So there's sort of a cottage industry right now of former counterterrorism analysts and people who worked for years like myself in the counterterrorism environment under the government and intel agencies. Now you see a lot of them. Juliet Kayyem, the Harvard woman who was a high-level counterterrorism official, slashed the tires of the truckers, right? She came out with a tweet and so basically there's sort of a cottage industry, I'd say, of former counterterrorism officials who are sort of saying our next challenge is right-wing domestic extremism. So after January 6th, Malcolm Nance was saying that we should drone strike these people. There's NPR articles of former CIA, I think, deputy station chiefs who are saying, treat these people worse than we would ever treat Al-Qaeda. Treat them as Taliban facilitators. And they were saying, drone strike, drone strike, drone strike. And I recognize it was an emotional time and people were heated, but this has sort of continued apace. You'll see a CNN commentator now at Yale, Asha, she basically is saying the same thing. When a pilot was interpreted to say, let's go, Brandon, she compared it to ISIS. So there's this whole normalization of treating American citizens who pretty much are on the right, or at least dissent from the Biden narrative. narrative as potential terrorists. So if we could restrain ourselves to actual, you know, right-wing terrorists, actual terrorism, then I would say, okay, Marshall, you have a great point. But we've proven that the slope is indeed slippery. And that's what really bothers me. When Sergey Brin, I looked through all these leaked tapes at a Google Friday meeting, goes up after Trump is elected and said, oh, these people are enthralled to extremism. That's the only way they could have voted for him. And that's starting to manifest in the way Facebook rolls out pilot programs with extremism warnings for little old ladies who just listen to Fox. I think that's that is a problem. It's a slippery slope, and we need to be extremely aware of guarding against it, because we're seeing it happen in America today.
See, and this is why I wanted to talk with you, because there's a left-leaning cottage industry, but there's also like a right-leaning cottage industry of people who are talking about censorship, all these things. And you're talking about censorship, but you worked in positions of conspicuous responsibility. So I really appreciate your understanding of the tension here. So here's a refined nuance that we're trying to basically get to. As you stated, there's this real creeping definitional expansion that's very clearly happening. No disagreement there. But as you also stated, there have been serious right-wing terrorist acts. So how do we, and once again, there's other contexts where there could be left-wing ones, not probably what about us, but like that's a thing. How do we then sequester it? Because because someone is going to have to, right? Like whether or not we disagree with it or not, there is someone in good faith at Facebook, at the State Department, at the, you know, DHS, who has to say, how do we prevent a Norway attack or a New Zealand attack? So how would you advise the people who are in the positions of responsibility, who are sympathetic to what you're saying, what should they do?
Yep. So, you know, as any good intelligence officer who focused on counterterrorism would tell you, the way that you determine, you know, if an attack is imminent or if an attack is actually a reasonable thing to consider is you weigh intent versus capability. And right now, I think just having a real grounding in that tradecraft, in that analytical tradecraft, I think that's entirely missing from the conversation in these tech companies. And I think initially they did a good job. I mean, they pulled from intel agencies to staff up these programs. But even when I was there, there was a push. I mean, we worked with the Southern Poverty Law Center, and you can't really say that they're neutral arbiters of hate groups at this point. They target a lot of pro-family and pro-biology organizations as hate groups. So there was a push within the organization to start to focus on, I would say, just more mainstream right ideas. So you have to get back to the real tradecraft of the people, I think, who've done this and haven't sold out to CNN and MSNBC against American citizens, and say, okay, intent versus capability. Is grandma, you know, walking and minding the velvet ropes in the Capitol, is her intent and her capability going to lead to some sort of devastating attack? Probably not. So we should sort of move away from, you know, anybody who milled about that day. I know there are issues with, clearly I'm talking January 6th, but, you know, in taking the full weight of the counterterrorism apparatus and the United States built up and employing it against people without the intent and capability really that we would consider even above a threshold in a CT analysis debate. To me, we need to get back to the real tradecraft. We need to actually figure out the ground truth for all this, because it's just expanded so much. And I think that is, there needs to be limiting principles and limiting factors, and I don't see it right now. So get back to that real counterterrorism analytical tradecraft, use it to inform the policies that these companies are coming up with. But right now it's run amok. I think it's overcorrected in one direction, and it's going to be very, very difficult to pull back. But as I said before, and I think people don't really appreciate this if they haven't been at the headquarters of these companies, and we would tell each other and we would say it out loud, you're building an airplane in mid-flight. Their technology will always outpace attempts to govern it, right? And even you have governing entities within these companies. But when I got there in 2016, we weren't even allowed to call what we were doing a policy. You know, we were a big global corporation who very much behaved as a scrappy startup and thought of ourselves as a scrappy startup. So we were trying to give some sort of structure and and some systemic rigor to what we were doing. But at the same time, it's a different sort of mentality. And I think it plays into the idea that, you know, and Antonio Garcia Martinez says this, you know, DC, nobody cares about DC. And I'm saying, if you're in Silicon Valley, using Silicon Valley as sort of a catch-all, I know geographic things have changed since COVID, but if you're working in these companies, you're not really thinking about, you know, what the policies coming out of DC. You are a little more now because there's a lot of energy behind it. But before, the locus of power in the universe was you. And you realize that you could ship, right? And you wait for everyone else to catch up later. So we were, in our minds at least, we were ahead of the State Department and all of these things. You know, we were ahead of this lumbering, sclerotic government apparatus in all of these things. And we were doing and we were building and we were waiting for everyone else to catch up. So yeah, it's really, really difficult for these companies to be able to put forth things that make sense to us here in DC, but it's a fitful, energetic, insanely beautiful nightmare, a maelstrom that's going on in there. And it's very, very difficult to basically have the capacity of an Intel regime that's existed for so long and worked a lot of problems out in a tech company. So what I'm basically saying to you is your vision, while pristine and beautiful, and I'd love to see it enacted, it's going to be very, very difficult to get there without a lot of mistakes and a lot of practice.
So Kara, to this point then, what is the end game? Because in my opinion, look, America, technology, all of this dynamism, that's how it works. So what you do is you have a unique set of principles, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and you try and govern yourself within those with the variability that a lot of crazy shit is going to happen. And, you know, Marshall, I would say this also to your point. Personally, and this is going to sound harsh, I think that we accept that in a free, open, liberal society like the United States, we're going to have a lot more downside than in many other countries. Denmark and many of these other people, they don't have freedom of speech, all these other things. They have very, very little violence. They also have very, very little ability in order to speak out. And so there comes with that a cost. We have the Second Amendment. We have a shit ton of gun deaths. So be it. That's how it is. So whenever I look at this, what I see is what is lacking, Kara, even with respect to what you were saying, building the plane. I don't think you should be building the plane. I think we should be limited by a policy. And this is what you were saying, by explicitly rejecting the term policy, it was a huge mistake. We point back to the Hunter Biden thing. They wake up one day, they see the story, Twitter, they freak out. They're like, oh my God, it's foreign misinformation. Like, we don't want to be governed by, or we don't want to get hit with the same attack by Facebook did, and Russia gators, and blah, blah, blah. And boom, next thing you know, you've censored the New York Post on Twitter, which, as you call, is election interference. And I agree with that. So a policy, in my opinion, would have prevented that. I'd be like, okay, this is a fucking new organization. It gets to publish. So be it. Liability is on them. If Hunter wants to sue them for defamation, which he hasn't because it's all true, then he's welcome to. So that's my question to you. What is the end game in the policy such that maybe we can just accept, we're like around guns. We're like, yeah, we have a Second Amendment. It is what it is. You can nibble out on the edges. New York can be the most extreme and say you can't carry one. Texas and here in Virginia where I am, you can say, yeah, you can buy one, you know, off the street. But we're still constrained within a narrow set of everybody gets to generally have a gun. So what do you think about what I just said?
Sager, I again, 2 years ago, even 1.5 years ago, I would have disagreed with you vehemently and said, no, the devil's in the details. Like, let's lean into the nuance. I completely disagree with old me at this point. And the crossing the Rubicon moment was the Hunter Biden laptop story during the election cycle of 2020. And I, at the risk of seeming like a sycophant, I believe in exactly what you're saying. AGM, again, Antonio Garcia Martinez, at the risk of referencing him twice now.
He'll love that. Don't worry.
I know. I think it's you use the Bill of Rights, you use the God-given rights enshrined in the Declaration of Independence and then the Constitution, you use that as your moral standards and your lodestar. So when we talk about Section 230 reform, you know, all the lawyers are like, oh, the First Amendment protects everyone and blah, blah, blah. But I'm saying, no, use that First Amendment as that moral standard, as he says, from which all of your policies then flow. So it's a, there, I guess the theme of what I'm saying is you got to go back to the basics here, because we've so corrupted ourselves in terms of, you know, not uniformly applying these policies. They can call them policies now. They just couldn't in the beginning. Oh, okay. And yeah, they do it now. But before it was like, no, we're still young and cool. And this is us. But in terms of, you know, having a policy, the policy should be the framing principles of the United States of America that we all live by. And our democracy, our republic is messy, right? And I think there has to be a lot of tolerance for that too, especially when you come into these freedom of expression issues. And tech companies have, I mean, they were, I think the impulses of these founders were initially with us, right? They originally, every time Mark Zuckerberg was caught on the spot when it came to free expression and, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, more speech is better. That's what he likes. That's what I think he was trying to do when he, when his platform after the Harvard days sort of matured. But now he's been railroaded by, we can get into all of that. But at the same time, these companies, they need to get back to, I think, the first principles of the United States. I know they're global corporations and they have global constituencies. Over 90% of the user base of Facebook is outside of the US and Canada. But at the same time, they're American companies incorporated in America. They grew and they flourished and they thrived under our distinctly American system. So we need to understand and have more of a cognition of that within the hallways of these companies. What struck me a lot too was just the general ingratitude for all of that, right? For the American system under which they thrived and, you know, became these behemoths in a huge way that America projects power. So getting back to that, having that as the framework. And then you can get into the technical like details of rule sets, like if then that, and sort of new noodle on the nuance there when you operate within the framework of, frankly, the first principles of America. I think that's you're exactly right. Mm-hmm. They've proven themselves irresponsible stewards of the power that they've aggrandized, and there needs to be a reckoning.
See, this is really interesting because this is where, and I really take your point that harping on nuance is not particularly useful in this particular policy environment. But I think within the environment of the podcast, the thing I want to basically harp on here is the First Amendment, right, is obviously specifically about government. And I know this is like a generic talking point the libertarians use, but what I'm trying to illustrate here is no one actually runs, you don't run your household by the First Amendment. A company isn't actually run by the First Amendment. Try to unionize at Amazon and ask yourself whether or not that's actually true when it comes to freedom of assembly. Because once again, there's a principle, and I agree with you pointing out the principle of free speech, the principle on self-determination, all sorts of corporate actions throughout our history, from company towns forcing you to buy from the company store, Pinkerton. There's all these examples of like violating that principle. So I'm not saying companies should just ignore principle, do whatever they want. But I guess the question here is, and this gets to your, once again, your national security experience, because I think, Sagar, your point about Hunter Biden, totally agree. In terms of the disaster within Twitter. I agree on the news publication bit here. But what was happening there, if you're sympathetic to Twitter management, is that, holy crap, in 2016, there was all this talk of how Facebook was under assault by foreign intelligence agencies. This is indisputable. We like obviously Russiagate became incredibly cringe, but we're talking about the kernel of truth and veracity that like then led to the complicated part of the discussion here. But if you're Facebook, you were racked over the coals for 4 years because the CIA knew about this. This was in news reports and they did not crack down on that information. That information didn't shift the election. That's not the claim here, but it happened on their platform. So if you are at, you know, Twitter, you're thinking, holy crap, if this turned out to have been the FSB or Russia or China, and we didn't crack down on this, we would have been wrecked the next 4 years. So once again, to the government side of you, to the tech person side of you, what should, because they listen, like we have big tech people who are listening to this podcast. What should they respond to the scenario I just described? Because I'm so sympathetic to the, not to their terrible design, as Sagar said here, but to the freak out. They're like, oh my God, if I screw this up, I'm going to be hauled in front of Congress 2 years from now. And Rachel Maddow is going to run segments saying I'm a criminal. I mean, like Scott Galloway, I like Scott Galloway, but Scott Galloway on Pivot is saying Facebook executives need to be arrested the second they get off at a European airport, which is psycho. But like, that's what a tech executive is thinking. So
enough cringe, Scott, please.
Yeah, please. We like you, Scott. Stop.
I'm making a plea to you. Yeah.
But anyway. So what's your response to that dilemma they're in?
Yeah, so I think this is really interesting. And what it all comes down to right now is resource allocation. So there's a huge problem. I totally agree with state-linked actors who are, you know, messing up all of these social media platforms. The whole in Discord, you know, Russia on these platforms in 2016, China now amplifying cheerleaders for the CCP and sort of taking little bits and pieces from what Russia did as well. I do think this is a problem, but I think companies have to be very careful to sort of work their resource priorities to these state-linked actors, right? Because I do think foreign influence is a massive problem, but you're not seeing that right now. Instead, you're seeing the uneven, inordinate application of these content moderation policies to one subset of American thinkers. I do want to admit that there, when it comes to state-linked actors and attribution, it is very difficult to extricate, you know, what an American actually thinks and says organically versus what a Chinese bot is putting in their heads. But it's very, very tough to sort of disentangle all of that, because Russia in particular will use fringe news sources that then sometimes get picked up by more authoritative news sources that then get seeded on these platforms as well. And China is pretty famous for, it's not my definition, but for basically taking patriotic netizens and outsourcing their information operations to people who, you know, in the diaspora who just really like China and they're Chinese patriots. So I think it's very, very, these are tricky, tricky questions, especially when it comes to attribution, because the more murky you can make that, the less accountability a state actor has. So let's devote our resources at these tech companies to ferreting that out. Maybe with the public availability component, yes, there's a cat and mouse race between bad actors and what they're doing, and then are, you know, good actors' attempts to thwart them. That's an issue of publicizing all of this. But I think big tech companies are not paying enough attention at this point in time. I think there was a year or so, 2017-ish, when they tried to disentangle all of that. But now they seem to be focused on, you know, the Joe Rogans of the world, given a lot of the COVID issues bringing it to the fore. The election security DHS stuff really bothers me too. But let's, again, pull back to what really matters. Let's take out those CCP state-linked bots and actors and users that are proliferating on the platform. Focus on those guys first. And then I think you would see a diminution of some of this really bad information that's occurring on these platforms, because it originates and is pushed from some of these state-linked actors. So focus on the state. Be very careful to try to disentangle as best as possible. Devote resources to doing so. And then I think you have a better idea. I mean, I wrote a whole report on this at CNIS before on, you know,
we'll link
state.
To that.
Yeah. So you know, that's one way to take care of it. But I think these companies have to be much more careful in trying to figure out those state linked sort of, you know, two hops, three hops away, rather than pursuing sort of real organic American thought, like what comes out of Joe Rogan's mouth.
And what's so helpful here, because I want to get to, Sagar and I disagree on this a bit, but I want to get to where we actually agree, which is that I think your idea of just getting back to the core thing is so actually helpful here. And the key thing is, in that New York Post story, there was no evidence that it was Russia or that it was China. So even under Sagar's standard, this wasn't as if the CIA was like, hey, guys, like, we have a literal evidence that this thing happened, or hey, this is coming from Facebook bot.news.exe Twitter account created yesterday.
But
this
Marshall,
is the New York Post. So to Sagar's point, if they had a policy that said, hey, when there's no evidence that something nefarious is up and it's a news publisher with a freaking blue check, let's just let it slide. The point is that was compatible with, the point is you don't even have to be as sympathetic to them as I was, given Sagar's, and I think your standard that's helpful here.
But Marshall, the problem with that too, and I want to agree and say, yes, we're all right here, is remember the letter signed by a bunch of former high-level IC officials that said, this is all the hallmarks of
hallmarks,
Russian disinformation?
Hallmarks.
Yep. So to me, that we need to really question ourselves. And that is why I'm so worried about these counterterrorism officials labeling everything as domestic extremism and domestic terrorism, because they've lost their darn minds. They've lost their heads. You know, these people who are saying, yeah, absolutely, signing their names to it. These people were literally at the highest levels of the United States intelligence community and intelligence apparatus with great deals of responsibility. And they presided over this letter that was clearly bunk. They're continuing to write more letters about how if you touch big tech, then we're going to lose the China competition. The overlap between some of those names, I suggest people take a look at that too. Very, very interesting. So I think when people are actually honest with themselves, have to have the humility to understand that, yeah, maybe Trump broke me. Maybe I'm a little, my emotions have gotten in the way of my cool-headed analytical tradecraft and acumen. I think until then, until our U.S. officials just calm down and stop demonizing the people within their own country, I don't think any of the solutions that we've proposed here are possible. I think maybe we'll get there, but it's going to take a lot of cold water, especially on these former counterterrorism and intel officers to basically give sober assessments of what's going on. That needs to happen first and foremost.
Yeah. They can attack me if they want. I will say this. I think they are 10 times a bigger threat to this country than a bunch of clown oath keepers who are mostly organized by the feds anyway. And I'll put that 100% down. So my question to you, Kara, is what do we do about it? You've just written a new report here, which proposes some solutions. Let's get into it a little bit. Try and give us the itemized version if you're able.
All right. Yeah, super quick. I think, in effect, the proposals that we're talking about now at the Heritage Foundation was we'd start with enforcing antitrust laws, right? And we're very careful to say this doesn't spread to other sectors. We're not Lena Khan, reincarnated. There has to be bright line tests, limiting factors. This needs to be narrowly focused on specific areas of the tech sector. It shouldn't bleed and help remake the economy in the image of the left. But laws need to be enforced. They exist to be enforced. And if there are proof of anti-competitive and predatory practices, then enforce the law, scrutinize these tech companies, use relevant federal agencies to enforce the law. And if there needs to be tweaks and modernization and reform, we're not opposed to having that on the table either. You know, we, again, tech always outpaces attempts to govern it. So there's got to be ways to, figure out what's going on and then have principles of governorship over some of these tech developments. I think we need to scrutinize big tech's business models, right? Their ad tech model, this is the beating heart of what these companies do. They care about they exist to create revenue. They're companies. Their bottom line at all costs is huge. User growth at all costs is what they care about, and their brand and reputation. Scrutinizing that ad tech model and the exploitation of data going on within these companies, I think that really cuts to that number one priority for them. And it's going to make them swivel their head to DC and say, okay, maybe we need to change our behavior. So I think that's critical too, looking at the ad tech models. Hold their executives liable for some of the deleterious effects that they're enforcing on the population. And I said enforcing is hyperbolic, but I mean, when people use their products, there's not truth in lending there necessarily. So that also brings us to data legislation. So I think there has to be some sort of framework for protecting people's data, or at least being transparent about it. People should know how their data is used, collected, stored, and shared. There's got to be some form of algorithmic impact transparency as well. We shouldn't have to wait for Frances Haugen to leak a bunch of documents to say, oh yeah, we tweaked that algorithm and these are the impacts that it's having on our users. And overall, they're pretty insalubrious to the average American. There needs to be transparency. There needs to be teeth to that transparency reporting requirement. And there needs to be a public availability component. And I'd say include content moderation practices and behavior and mistakes in those impact assessments as well. I think a huge part that you guys might be interested in is, first of all, making sure tech companies don't work with the government and let themselves be used as agents to chill speech. Massive. But also, let's make sure that these tech companies aren't working with our adversaries like the CCP. You guys probably heard about the 2016 deal that The Information broke. It's a outlet, another online outlet. And they, Tim Cook signed
this is,
a deal.
This is crazy town.
Yeah. Crazy town. $275 billion to help with Chinese development. Right. What is going on here? So we absolutely should take measures to prohibit joint ventures like that. And then, you know, while I'm on the CCP subject, you know that CCP spokespeople, the Ayatollah, they're all over Twitter. They're spewing whatever bile all over these platforms, speaking martial of what we talked about before, misinformation, disinformation that's state linked. Yet they're totally untouched. And Trump can't even get a word in on Twitter at this point. So there, if there's no reciprocity, which we know there's not going to be reciprocity, we can't get on digital platforms in China like they can get on ours. And even don't get me started on TikTok too. But if there's no reciprocity, then they should not, these state-linked actors, these spokespeople for adversary regimes should not be on our US-owned digital platforms. And then just generally giving Americans new ways to sort of fight back if they feel that their user rights have been infringed upon, if there are real cases of fraud and breach of contract, I think those need to be explored as well. And then finally, tech companies have a huge role to play in this too. We need to build with all levels of the digital stack in mind. That is to insulate ourselves against what happened to Parler when Amazon Web Services declined to host them on or give them cloud hosting services infrastructure. So that's huge too. Privacy preserving technologies so you can build in the design of these products, the insulation against data exploitation and privacy exploitation by these companies and not having to go retrofit it back with legislation. That's a big deal too. So transparency, privacy, prompt and meaningful recourse for American users, enforcing our laws, all of these elements are very, very critical to getting after the problem.
Man, Kara, I will give you hardcore praise. That was the best ever.
It's a great summary.
That was the best ever. Hey, we're nearing the end. Summarize your POV. Not even kidding. That was just sort of like super, super, super great. Okay. Well, so just three quick questions to wrap. And Sagar has a super hard stop at the hour. So if you go over by a minute, his camera will just shut off and we'll be okay there.
Sorry.
So here's the last three questions. So one, I'm not sure how much you follow the broader like Web3 next internet discourse. Here's what really matters here. This isn't about like, what do you think about NFTs and DAOs? This is basically just Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook/Meta are making this huge bet that there will be some new version of the internet. So like there's at least stakes here. How are you as a national security professional thinking about how at least we could be entering a different era of tech? The conversation we're having, we keep talking about, well, in 2016, this thing happened. If 2018, this thing happened, Zuck is betting. And previous tracker records suggest that despite Facebook stock plunging, we should at least be credible when he makes a bet like this. How are you just thinking about this new conversation?
You know, again, at the risk of saying my thinking has developed too much, you know, I think when we hear what everyone has to say, we refine our own thinking. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. From a national security perspective, I understand that there are trade-offs. But right now, I think the risk of not employing more of these decentralized technologies, given what's happening with freedom of expression in the tech world today, I think the risks of not employing them very much outweigh the benefits. So of actually having that national security chain of custody and, you know, being able to follow the money really well, et cetera, et cetera. I think distributed ledgers are huge. I think Web3, you know, the internet was fostered and people got there. They're able to get all these network effects on these platforms because it was created to democratize information, right? To air marginalized voices, to give everybody sort of a say in the public discourse. We've seen that from the top down, when you're consolidating power and abusing that power, that it's the reality is far more complicated. I think Web3 is an opportunity. I think the decentralization is a future. I'm not a Balaji acolyte, but I think he has a lot of good things to say when it comes to just the fact that you can harness the original democratic promise of these technologies. And I think Web3 is a great way to do it. I think it's critical to basically start building with that in mind. And I think it's going to be critical for people more on the right, people who believe in the realignment and who want to be able to speak freely in the future, because that's how we do it. The dehumanizing aspects of the metaverse really, really bother me. I'm a believer, so I think we are body soul composites, right? And I think there's nothing more illustrative of how insidious really that particular technology is than you're sort of a floating sort of half body head, right, in the metaverse. So to me, I think James Poulos is great on this. We need to make sure that our technologies also reflect what it is to be human. I think Web3 does get a lot better with regard to that whole aspect of capturing the dignity of human beings within our technology and having it reflect that. So I'd lean into that for sure.
Yeah, Kara, I have to jump off. I just wanted to say I really enjoyed this. Marshall, you'll continue my absence. It's been really fantastic. So thank you, Kara. I appreciate it.
Of course, anytime.
And just to finish with this, your report actually starts with a quote: "Too many gatekeepers of information for the American public, elite media, academia, government institutions, and various organs of culture are captured by leftist ideology." The real thing here is that the policy proposals, the debates we're having, nothing is effectively going to happen at a major structural level for a minimum of effectively 4 years, which, as you know, having worked in tech, is actually forever. So it seems like we're just caught in this weird in-between where the individual views of people at these companies are going to determine everything, because that's what an ungoverned space looks like. I just want you to close by reflecting on that reality where we could have all the solutions we want, but there's no consensus. And even if there were a consensus, the Republicans, which the side you're aligned with, like, don't control both houses of Congress. They don't control the presidency. So you couldn't even get what you are wanting here on a principle level. And so I just love you to close by reflecting on the weird in-between we are whenever we – this is a frustration whenever we have any tech conversation, left, right, or center. We're just stuck no matter what.
Yeah, it's this really unsatisfying liminal space, I'd say. And I think at this point, my entire motivation is to front load all of this as fast as possible, as robustly as possible, as deeply researched as possible, so that we can, when we're ready to move and can actually make an impact and have an effect on sort of the behavior that we're trying to shape, I think we just got to be ready to go when that actually happens. And I really appreciate you bringing all these super interesting thinkers together. And I think the more that we can talk amongst ourselves and really try to figure out the efficacious ways to keep us human, to contribute to human flourishing, and to figure out how technology is best postured to do so before the moment comes where we can actually ship, then I think the better we are. We're positioning ourselves to actually make an impact, even if we can't do it tomorrow.
Yeah, I love what you said, because we get a lot of reader mail, and the number one thing people say is they bring up frustrations regarding the dynamic that I just described. And I think your response, Yuval Levin at AEI once said that he saw his role as like putting the books on the bookshelf, so that sometimes when a moment does come and things will be done, there's something there. So I just want to echo to the audience what Kara said, regardless of what issue you're interested in, if you're frustrated by the dysfunction of this moment, you could testify that there's a trillion different things that need to be done from a preparation perspective that are going to be really key no matter what happens moving forward. So I think that's a great place to end. Kara, thank you so much for joining. I would love for you to shout out anything that you'd like our audience to go take a look at that you've produced recently, aside from the report, obviously.
Yeah, so we had that big tech report, so I'll let it take up all the oxygen. If you guys haven't read it yet, it's a 14,000, it's really like a 25 minute word read. So take a look at that on heritage.org/big tech. And yeah, tell us what you think. We're getting a lot of feedback, and it's all been so interesting. I love the conversation. I love the raucousness. So I'd like for it to keep going.
Yeah, Kara, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Marshall. We'll
reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.